Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on July the 4th. July the 4th, 2018. Of course, July the 4th, we salute the United States, as we always like to do on this amazing day of history. Today, we're going to be talking with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We're going to be looking at the American political scene as we're pretty much halfway through this year, 2018. I mean, the midterms are 5 months away, 4 months away. They're getting closer. There are some signs, and at the same time, there are no signs. It's one of those things where, you know, I think a lot of people are using this information or that information to promote their own side. But I think at the moment, we can safely say that there is no red wave and there is no blue wave. That much we could probably say at the moment. We'll be talking a little bit about the Democrats. We'll be talking about what the Democrats are doing to themselves, which is unbelievable, in my opinion. They're just shooting themselves by taking positions that I think are pushing the party out of the mainstream. And the Supreme Court made a couple of very interesting decisions this week that I think solidify the President Trump as well as the Republican Party or the conservative movement in the United States, particularly the one about the public sector unions and having, you know, to contribute to public sector unions. And we'll talk a little bit about Mexico. Mexico has a new president-elect who is very popular in Mexico, but also faces, I think, some horrific challenges that he's going to have to deal with very quickly. So a lot on our plate tonight as we talk to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. How are you, Barry?
I'm fine. Happy birthday, America.
That's right. Happy number 242. Happy number 242. I often wonder, Barry, and I know you're a student of the Founding Fathers, but I've often wondered if anybody had said to one of these guys back then on this day in 1776 that we would be celebrating number 242. I don't know. I think that maybe there would have been, how can I say, some reluctance to believe that, Barry? The odds are against, we're against the American Republic, but yet it succeeded, Barry.
Well, I think, in a way, however, the Founding Fathers were, and they were an interesting group of people of varied backgrounds, but they were very, considering that they were living in a colonial, then colonial country, they were pretty well educated. They were pretty well to do. They were very successful in most cases, as not only as farmers or businessmen or publishers, they had a variety of religions and perspectives, but they'd all read, virtually all of them had been reading the European enlightened writers, and had come to conclusions about a modern political state that they wanted to create. They made a lot of compromises to reach finally the Constitution that we now use, although it's been amended and changed and evolved. But I'm not so sure they would be so totally surprised. Of course, they would have no idea about all the technology and inventions, mm-hmm. changes that have taken place in the world, and all the history that has sure. taken place since then, but I think they really intended to create a lasting, mm-hmm. not only a lasting constitution and document, but a lasting nation. And I think they would have, whether surprised or not, they would have been certainly pleased to
right,
know
right.
that the country is still going and still going strong.
Right, and I think you're right about that. I think you're right about that because I think they were very serious people. And I think serious people do things for the long run. So I think you're exactly right about that. Now, one quick thing about July 4th, 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, you have John Adams and Thomas Jefferson passed away. on this day. I've always felt that that is so incredible. What an incredible coincidence that is, that these two men, I think at the time they were the last two founding fathers left around, you know, and yet for them, for the two of them to pass away this day, it was just an unbelievable coincidence. That it, you know, when you say it, it's kind of hard to believe. It sounds like a movie, like a fairy tale, Barry.
Well, I think they both were aware that each other, that they were ailing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jefferson particularly was making a serious effort to keep going until he learned what happened to his once adversary but always his collaborator, John Adams. They were on the opposite political side in some ways, but of course they were collaborators in creating the country, and they were two of the most important persons. Yes, it is
mm-hmm.
interesting, but life and history is full of these kind of
right, exactly.
To be
yeah,
coincidence.
You're right. You're right, and it's just something that every time I read it, I just, you know, it's just one of those things that just touches you so well. And then one quick thing here. I know you being a Yankee fan and both of us being baseball fans, it was on this day, July the 4th, 1939, that Lou Gehrig said farewell to baseball. They had a special day for Lou Gehrig, and he didn't make too many more appearances after this. I you know, he passed away a couple of years later, but that's another angle to July 4th, you know, the Lou Gehrig day in 1939, Barry.
Right. Well, it was a famous speech
mm-hmm.
That he made, and he was a very beloved figure, you know, in some ways, the first the Yankee I think of who also had was well loved was Derek Jeter. There are certain players in history who, in addition to being outstanding players, are beloved not only by their teammates but by the fans for various reasons, and Lou Gehrig was certainly one of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we remember that day, that great speech of Lou Gehrig. Well, let's get into the politics. We're going to talk, as I mentioned, about Mexico. President Trump, politically at the moment, seems to be on a strong position. The Democrats, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot with some of the things they're doing. And then the Supreme Court made some important decisions. Let's go to Mexico first. We don't often devote this much time to Mexico, but I think this time it's required because of the big election they had and some of the controversy with Mexico over NAFTA and immigration and so on. López Obrador, who, as you pointed out in your piece here in the last 48 hours that I read, was the mayor of Mexico City. A lot of people don't know that he was the mayor of Mexico City, had turned out to be kind of a pragmatic guy. You're exactly right in your piece. There were some scandals around, nothing that brought him down, but certainly some of the people around him. Mexico City is a very difficult city to run, as anybody who is familiar with the city. I mean, it's Mexico City is larger. If Mexico City was a country, it would be larger than any other Central American country. It would be larger than many South American countries. I think it would be one of the top 10 economies of Latin America just by itself, maybe even bigger than that. So it's a huge city, very difficult to run like any other big city. And people think that he was kind of, you know, they don't give him a great grade, but at the same time, they don't think he failed. Probably C+ is what I would probably give him. But this year, he ran as very much of a populist, and some people call him a left-wing populist, and maybe there's some truth to that. He tapped into a lot of anger in Mexico with the political establishment. He won the election, and he won big over, there were four candidates. He got 53% of the vote, so that's a significant victory. And now he's the president-elect of Mexico, and as you pointed out in your post, Barry, let's see how he gets along with President Trump. So let me hear you talk about this.
Well, he was the mayor. Mexico City is actually two entities. There's the actual city itself, which has a population of just under 9 million. But the Distrito Federal, the district of which he was the mayor, he wasn't the mayor of just the city, he was the mayor of the federal district, is actually 21 million plus, which makes it the largest metropolitan area in all of the Western Hemisphere, and certainly one of the 5 or 10 largest in the world, although there's several in China, which are even bigger. And São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro are also very big places. But Mexico City is huge. I have actually been there, spent a couple weeks there. It's a very high altitude place. It's a beautiful city in many ways, with extraordinary skies and lots of interesting old buildings. A famous square called the Zócalo. I think it's called the Zócalo. And, of course, it's where the government is. He made a lot of promises, and has been pointed out, although he kept some of them, he didn't keep most of them. But he was always, from the very beginning, he was a champion of the poor and the rural Mexicans, many of whom have been long suffering. And so he became a sort of a populist hero. And as I have written, even when scandal emerged and criticism emerged, his own supporters ignored it, and in fact felt that the attacks on López Obrador were politically motivated by his enemies. And in that respect, he shares something with President Trump, whose supporters seem to be solidly behind him in spite of all the massive media bias and attacks on him by the media and by some of his opponents, and even some of his fellow Republicans. López Obrador ran for president twice before. He resigned as mayor in 2005 to run for president in 2006, and came very close. It was very close. There was a disputed election to some degree, but rather than cause a problem, he accepted the result. He ran again. The terms in Mexico are 6 years. You can't run again. It's a one-term limit. So he ran again in 2012, and this time it was almost a tie. And after the election was over and they declared Mr. Calderón, the conservative leader, the president, López Obrador said, "No, I'm the president-elect." And he called his supporters out in Mexico City and elsewhere to demonstrate, and there was a crisis. But finally, the Mexican election board decided that he had lost, and finally he accepted the result. And so he had lost twice, but by very close margins. And so it was an interesting contrast. This time, he was always the favorite, and he won by a landslide. And you shouldn't underestimate, with you have several major candidates. There were 4 major candidates, including Mr. Calderon, running as an independent in the race this time. And for him to get 53% and far more, 25% more than the next highest candidate, was more than a landslide. It was a huge landslide. And he won control of both houses of the Congress.
Right. I think that's the biggest victory right there, the fact that he won the legislature. I think that's what gives him the most power. Now, I, obviously we wish him well, and we hope that he does well, because it's important for Mexico to succeed. But one of the points that I wanted to make, Barry, is that now that he's the president of Mexico, he obviously has to govern the country and make sure that the economy is stable. And one of the ways that you, having lived in Mexico and knowing Mexico fairly well, one of the ways that you have a growing economy in Mexico is when you have a growing economy in the United States, because the two economies are very much tied together. And obviously, so at this point, Mr. López Obrador needs for Mr. Trump's economic plan to succeed, because if it succeeds, López Obrador has an easier time governing. I mean, the last thing that López Obrador wants would be for Mexico to go into an economic crisis or a peso erosion. That's not going to make it easy for him to stand. So, in a way, these two men are very much almost like in the same airplane, Barry, all of a sudden.
Well, and I think one of the things that I pointed out in my article that hardly anyone else had bothered to point out was, and I saw it in an article I kept for many years, by an article which pointed out that in 2006, the first time he ran, and he ran as a populist, but mm-hmm. one of the things about López Obrador that I think is a positive sign is although he runs against the political and economic establishment of Mexico, that's his main emphasis on the corruption within Mexico. He doesn't really run against the United States. And he promised in 2006, and I believe he continues to feel this way, that it's very important for him as the president of Mexico to develop a good relationship with the president of the United States, whoever he or she mm-hmm. is, and that it's, and this supports your argument that you've made about the need for a good American economy to be helpful to a good Mexican economy. You know, Mexico, people forget, four American states used to be part of Mexico. And the mm-hmm. population of those four states, now they're not all Hispanic, of course, but the population of those four states is one-fifth, or a little more than one-fifth, of the whole U.S. population, because it includes Texas and California.
That's right.
Mexico and Arizona. And then Mexico, along with Canada, are two of our major trading partners in dollar amounts. And then it's, of course, we have a border, which, of course, has a lot of disputes right now, and they need to be resolved. Mr. López Obrador has always been an opponent of building a wall, and that will be an interesting conversation between him and Mr. Trump, who has made it a hallmark of his plans mm-hmm. for his relationship with Mexico. On the other hand, there's many areas where they can work something out, including the renegotiations of NAFTA. Now, interestingly enough, López Obrador has always been a critic of NAFTA.
Yes, he has.
From a different point of view than Mr. Trump is. His point of view is that, of course, in certain ways, NAFTA puts Mexicans at a disadvantage, and certainly Mr. Trump thinks the American interests are at a disadvantage. But it's plenty of room for negotiation, and if the first conversation, which was friendly, if not substantive, that they've already had, is worth anything, there's a possibility, especially in light of your comment and your assertion, that Mr. López Obrador needs for Mr. Trump to be successful, especially in the economic sphere, in order for Mexico to be successful. So our two countries have much in common. 34 million Americans speak Spanish. Not all of them are Mexican, because we have, like yourself, many Cuban Americans and Puerto Rican Americans and other Central American Americans and South American Americans. We have lots of people, and of course even a few people from Spain. But it's a culture which is key to part of the American culture, and it's something we need to pay a lot of attention to. And I think both presidents, López Obrador and Trump, will make a big effort to work something out. And it's something that lies ahead, because we really don't know what's going to happen. But
right,
it will make
a very interesting
conversation.
Oh, I agree.
Down the road.
I agree. I think this could be, this could be a potential problem relationship, but on the other hand, it could be a relationship that surprises us in the positive way. But one point that was made over and over about his election was the fact that the Mexican people are sick and tired of the violence. The violence has been just absolutely horrific. Now, to be fair, it's not in every corner. It tends to be in certain places more than others. But of course, all of it is cartel related. And one of the things that I think President Trump could do to enhance the relationship with López Obrador would be to publicly admit something that a lot of American presidents for one reason or another, have not said before. And I think President Trump needs to say, look, guys, we're the ones consuming this stuff. We're the ones funding the cartels. And I wish President Trump would say that, because I think that would give López Obrador, that would be good, I think, for the relationship. The biggest challenge, Barry, that he faces, in my opinion, is not the corruption. The corruption, I think, can be fixed. And in many ways, it has been fixed with the entrance of all these political parties into the equation over the last 20 years or so. But I think the biggest problem is the violence and how he reacts to the violence. The last two presidents of Mexico reacted differently. Calderón took on a very aggressive, in-your-face kind of approach against the cartels. Peña Nieto pushed it back a little bit. But we have the same problems we had before. The violence is horrific, and the people are sick and tired of it. So I think that is the one area where he's going to have to show some results, because I believe that a lot of people voted for him in much the same way that they voted for President Trump, in the sense that they were willing to take a chance because of his economic experience or the ability to fix the economy. I think down in Mexico it would be they took a chance in López Obrador because of his ability to maybe fix the violence. And so far President Trump is succeeding. We don't know, of course, how President López Obrador will do. So I have a feeling you and I will be talking about this a few times over the next couple of years, Barry.
I think so.
Yes. I think this is indeed going to be an important topic. Let me take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to go national and talk about our politics here in the United States. President Trump, who seems to be enhancing his political position, the Democrats at the moment, I think, making a lot of mistakes, I would argue shooting themselves in the foot in many ways. And the Supreme Court, made some very interesting decisions this week. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, July 4th evening. Happy birthday to the United States. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman. Let's talk about the United States. Barry, some interesting stories this week. President Trump, the Democrats, and the Supreme Court. Which one would you like to tackle first? I know you've written posts about all of them.
Well, I we could talk about the Supreme Court right away. Because in addition to the two of the three decisions were landmarks, the third one was very important because it involved the abortion issue, which involves so many strong feelings on both sides in America. And then, of course, after he decided with the conservative majority, as he usually does, Justice Kennedy announced his retirement, effective almost immediately. In fact, he will retire at the end of this term, which is days away. So there'll be a vacancy on August 1st, I believe. President Trump has promised to name his successor by July 9th, which is only 5 days away. So he of course had been thinking about, and it created a list of approximately 25 men and women, jurists, legal minds, all of them conservative, which he has said would be his list. He published this list before he became president, and in his first choice, he chose from among that list, and of course, he has now apparently narrowed it down to four or five finalists, all of whom are on that list. Two of them are women, two or three are men. They're all pretty conservative. The Democrats are understandably upset, but they're pretty powerless to stop this second choice, and they're caught in a bit of a political dilemma that I've pointed out, because although the Republicans have only a 51-49 majority, and at least one, maybe two of those Republicans are, well, two of them are pro-choice, and have said, one of them has said they will not support a pro-life nominee, which means they won't vote, they won't support whoever the president picks. And then there's Senator McCain, who's not very well and probably not coming back to Washington. On a partisan basis, they don't have the votes. But the Democrats are in a very, certain Democrats are in a very interesting and dilemma. Senator Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Heitkamp of North Dakota, and Senator Donnelly of Indiana represent states that Trump carried by a large margin, and where his choice for the Supreme Court will be very popular, presumably. They, when the Gorsuch appointment came up, they did something unusual. They voted for the president's choice to avoid being creating a political issue that would be used against them this year. Now, suddenly, just before the election, they are presented with this dilemma one more time. And it's hard to imagine that they will vote against President Trump's choice, because that will make a huge issue just before the election for their Republican challenger opponents. And I think the Democrats, and that's just three who have already done this. And if you add the three, that creates a majority, even without the senator from Maine and from Alaska, and Senator McCain. And I'm not, we don't know for sure. Only Senator Collins has indicated she would not vote. Now, the president has said that he is not going to ask any of his potential interviewees for the choice how they stand on Roe versus Wade. And even if they are quizzed about it when they get to the Senate hearings, no nominee will disclose what they will do. That's considered an improper question to ask a nominee for a judgeship, is how they will decide on particular issues. That's just considered improper, and unless they're politically suicidal, they won't answer that question. So that may give Senator Collins an out, although she's also indicated certain nominees are unacceptable no matter what. So it's a very interesting situation. Senator McConnell has indicated that as soon as the president puts up the nomination, by August, the hearings will be held, and certainly by September or October, a vote will be taken. And we now know, based on the Gorsuch nomination, that all you need is a majority vote to pass to confirm a nominee. No longer do you need 60 votes or two-thirds or whatever. That tradition has been ended, and a simple majority will confirm a nominee. So I think it's realistic to say Democrats aren't particularly happy, but he, after all, elections matter, and Trump was elected president, and he's the one who makes the nominations. And the Senate, the Democrats are looking very strong for the moment in the election for the next House of Representatives, and may even take back control, although that's not clear. But they're looking very good. There's a lot of vulnerable incumbent Republicans and certain redistricting events and decisions have been made which benefit the Democrats. But the exact opposite is true in the Senate, where three times as many Democrats are up for re-election, incumbents, and at least, although two, possibly three of the Republicans are vulnerable, 10, 11, or 12 of the Democrats are. And some of them, such as Senator Manchin, Senator Donnelly, and Senator Heitkamp, and Senator McCaskill, and Senator the senator from Montana, are very vulnerable, and the senator from Florida. So you have six very vulnerable Democrats. And it looks like even if the Democrats take back control of the House, which is possible, they don't even need a blue wave to do that. Just need to pick up 24 seats. It's also possible that the Republicans will score important victories and gains in the Senate, where, I mean, the members of the House do not confirm any appointments, be they judicial or administrative. The Senate does all the advise and consent. So that election is in some ways even more important
right.
than the House election this particular cycle. And this Supreme Court nomination that's forthcoming is key to perhaps how it will turn out. So the timing couldn't have been better for the Republicans.
Right. Absolutely.
And, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know who he's going to pick. There are he might pick a conservative woman, which mm-hmm. would present an interesting dilemma for the Democrats. And then there's, of course, a couple of very conservative Republican judges, and all of them, virtually all of them, are very young,
mm-hmm.
as was Neil Gorsuch, so that whoever gets picked is likely to be there for quite a while, long past President Trump's term or terms or even the next mm-hmm. the next president. And meanwhile, you have three aging members of the court, one Republican and two Democrats, who also might decide to leave the court, who certainly might be appointments for the president to make in this term, but if he gets reelected, will certainly probably have at least one or two more choices in his second term, should
right.
he be reelected. So
he could have a situation where he could end up with three or four picks, at least three, I think you're right. Three or four, maybe even four picks. But one of the things that frustrates me and about the Supreme Court nomination is how politicized it's gotten. And it all seems to be about Roe v. Wade. And I wish we could go back to a time when it wasn't all about Roe v. Wade, that it was more about, you know, the temperament of the judge or his or her experience. I mean, most of the people who are nominated or even being looked at are all very qualified people. And to somehow put them through this meat grinder of the Roe v. Wade questions. And by the way, one thing about Senator Collins up in Maine is that she left herself a little wiggle room, if you listen to what she said. She said a nominee who is hostile to, I think those were her words, hostile to Roe v. Wade. Well, more than likely, whoever Trump nominates or President Trump nominates is not going to talk one way or the other about Roe v. Wade. It'll be like Gorsuch, you know, whenever
right,
he was
exactly
asked that
what
question.
I just said.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that the Democrats, you know, they're hoping that a Republican will somehow, you know, trip himself or herself. Well, but I think these people are smart enough to know that you just say, look, I'm sorry, I cannot tell you how I'm going to vote on a future. But there is something happening, though, with the Supreme Court that I think is extremely important, and a decision that was made about the public sector unions. I think that is going to have an impact on our politics, Barry, because I've always felt that the public sector unions, while I'm not opposed to public sector unions, I do like private sector unions, but never been a big fan of public sector unions. But I do think they were too close to the Democrat Party. and collecting and donating political contributions. So this decision, I think, will break that up, Barry.
Well, as we saw in at least two states, I think more, certainly Scott Walker in Wisconsin and the Republican governor and legislature in Michigan did that very thing legislatively at the state level. And one of the things that happened was that the public sector employees, first of all, they didn't have the money, and then a lot of members of the union just did not renew their membership. So the unions have shrunk dramatically, certainly in Wisconsin, which was, of course, the sort of the model. Now, this is being imposed on judicially across the board. So now that it certainly affects, for example, states like Minnesota, where I live, where the teachers' unions are very powerful politically, particularly through their funding for Democratic candidates, now which will be much reduced because they won't have the funds to do it. And they will also have to scramble to keep their memberships high. So as you say, I mean, the history of unions in America is generally a positive one, especially in the early history when unions were a very necessary institution to protect workers and working men and women. And even today, can serve a useful purpose. However, the unions have become very political. And one of the things that is happening, it's happening in Minnesota. We saw that when the president came to Duluth a couple weeks ago and got such a huge turnout in a district that was traditionally Democratic and heavily labor and unionized. And those people are switching to the Republican Party. Donald Trump is turning the Republican Party into a working man's and working woman's party, a working class party in many ways, which explains, by the way, why so many Republican establishment figures are unhappy, because their power and influence is being diminished as he transforms the Republican Party. But the impact of the decision, as you rightly pointed out, could have enormous consequences. We'll have great ones anyway, no matter what. How big it will be, I don't know. I mean, a Supreme Court decision is pretty final, and as far what's happening here in Minnesota is that the conservative think tanks are already very actively making available information to both union members and non-union members who have been forced to pay dues, of just how to opt out so that they know how to do it. And so they're being assisted in responding to the decision. And, of course, most of those union and non-union members who choose not to, well, if you're a union member, you have to pay. But if you're a non-union member, you no longer have to pay. Your pay is going to go up. And rather significantly, union dues are not low. And that's how the unions have been able, right, such a powerful influence politically in assisting Democratic, almost entirely Democratic candidates in state, local, and national elections.
Right, and that's where I think they made a mistake, it seems to me, the public sector unions, by aligning themselves so much with one side or the other. Because if you're and I'll just give you an example. I know someone in Wisconsin who's a teacher who in 2012, Wisconsin was 52-47 for Obama over Romney, and they took a vote among the teachers. And, yes, Obama won the teacher vote, but there were many teachers who were going to vote for Romney. But yet the contributions of the union were, like, overwhelmingly 90%. For Obama, and I know there were several teachers who were very unhappy about that because they felt that their point of view was not taken into account. So I think the public sector unions made a big mistake when they became so aligned with the Democratic Party. They would have been a heck of a lot better off simply representing the interest of the members by asking the members, how would you like us to contribute? But I think the leadership didn't do that, and I think that contributed to some of the problems. As far as the private sector unions are concerned, I have absolutely no problem with that. I think private sector unions are good. But the difference between private sector unions and public sector unions is that private sector unions have to live in the reality of the marketplace. And, you know, you negotiate in the reality of the marketplace. So if the economy is not doing good, well, the union is not going to have the same leverage. So at least that's, you know, the back and forth that goes on that. Barry, let me take another quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about the Democrats a little bit and what is going on with the Democrat Party. It just seems, at least from my perspective, it's just shooting itself in the foot. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Again, happy 4th of July to everyone, this great American holiday. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman. Barry, we've got one more segment left, and I wanted to talk about the Democrats. From my point of view, okay, and I understand that I'm a partisan Republican, so I always put that on the table, but I'm trying to be as objective as I can with the Democrats. It sure looks to me like they're shooting themselves in the foot with some of their tactics, like abolish ICE, you know, the just absolutely fanatical attacks on the president and his family. I mean, it just seems crazy what is happening on that side, and it seems to me they're shooting themselves in the foot, Barry.
Well, many Democrats and some Republicans have never accepted the results of the 2016 election. They still can't believe it. They're in a form of psychological denial and political denial. There was an illusion or delusion somehow that they could, from election night on, they were going to prevent the formal election, the swearing in, and then through impeachment, removing the president. These things are not realistic, especially in light of the fact that the Republicans control both houses of Congress. But even so, it was not a likely prospect. Democrats, the president, I mean, it was a big shock, his election. Now, you and I, in our discussions before the election, we openly predicted the possibility that Trump would win. In fact, right at the end, I think we both thought he was going to win. I know I did. I was saying and writing that it looked pretty good for the president. I certainly was sensing that. And I even sensed in Minnesota, which turned out to be true, that it was going to be very close based on a number of very interesting signals. But the Democrats really have been jarred. I mean, the other thing that complicated the 2016 election was Bernie Sanders was, I don't know whether he would have won it in the end or not, but he certainly had a much better chance than he was given, considering that the DNC and the party establishment was determined to nominate Hillary Clinton and to prevent Bernie Sanders from winning enough delegates to make the convention a real problem for her. There was a sense of injustice that many Bernie Sanders supporters had. They were more liberal, more left-wing, more radical in some ways, and they vowed after the election that they were going to not sit around and wait for the same thing to happen again, that they were going to be aggressive and take over the party. And what you have seen taking place all over the country, especially in states with large Democratic voter constituencies, you've seen the takeover of the Democratic Party by its Bernie Sanders wing. In some ways, I even read a column the other day saying that many of these voters feel that Bernie Sanders is too conservative. And certainly we're seeing individual cases.
I saw that. That was funny.
individual cases of candidates who are openly socialistic, openly calling for programs that have no real support outside the small groups that advocate them now. And this is what I believe you mean by shooting themselves in the foot. They can win party endorsements and win conventions and maybe even primaries, but can they win general elections with candidates far to the left? Now, we have a classic case of that in Minnesota, where we have, following the Democratic Farmer Labor TFL convention, we have the endorsed candidates who were left being challenged by well-known DFL candidates who don't accept the party endorsement and are vying for the nomination. In the case of the very key race for governor, the party endorsement was by a woman who's a legislator in St. Paul, and she picked another woman who's from St. Paul as her running mate, and she and this ticket has alarmed DFL leaders and candidates outstate because they advocate programs including single payer and free education, free college education, all kinds of populist programs that have no support and which in fact scare off not only Republicans but most importantly independent voters, some of whom were probably inclined to go for the Democratic candidate but now will be frightened from supporting them. So this is taking place across the country. Now, in certain areas, like in that case in that congressional race in was it Brooklyn or the Bronx, where the young woman defeated the longtime leader, Mr. Crowley, she's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
She won the primary. She's going to win the election.
Right.
So you'll have her in Congress. And you've got Elizabeth Warrens, the Maxine Waters, the Bernie Sanders already in place, who are also espousing strong views on the left. And this, it would seem, common sense would tell you that since the national elections, the November elections, are usually determined, as I've always written, in the political center, by mostly independent and non-affiliated voters. I mean, most Democrats are going to vote for Democrats, and most Republicans are going to vote for Republicans. That's a given. Then the question is only turnout of those two. But then there's another factor that's very important that I believe determines most American elections, certainly midterms and national elections, and that is the non-affiliated, independent, or loosely affiliated voters on both sides. These are the people who are undecided in many ways and who make their choices close to the elections often and based on not only the personalities but the issues that are brought to them. And this is the area where I believe that you're talking about, where I think you're saying that the Democrats are making life very difficult for themselves by espousing views which some might consider extreme.
Right. Well, I'll just give you two examples.
And Republicans,
yes,
are in a position, with some exceptions,
mm-hmm,
of being the more common sense, moderate figures in these elections. Certainly in Minnesota, if Tim Pawlenty is the Republican nominee, he will have broader appeal than on it would seem he would have broader appeal than Mrs. Murphy, who is more of an urban candidate and who represents, I mean, urban America is pretty left-wing, and the Twin Cities in Minnesota are vote overwhelmingly 75% Democratic, or here we call it DFL. So that isn't going to change very soon. But that's only 25% of the vote. Or in the case of Minnesota, only about 23% of the total vote. The real, and of course, urban, outstate and exurban Minnesota is pretty conservative. So the real key is in the suburbs. Well, the suburbs are fairly prosperous places. They are ethnically diverse these days in more ways than they used to be. But there's one way to lose those suburban voters is to frighten them economically. And, you know, one of the things we're going into is, and this could change, you know, there's no guarantees, but the economy seems to be going very well since the tax bill was passed and money is coming back from overseas and companies are investing their cash and unemployment is at levels I hardly can remember. So the levels are so low, and they're especially low among blacks and Hispanics, who usually have a high rate. And so what's going to motivate voters to vote against the party and the president and the candidates who are helping make that prosperity occur, as opposed to candidates who will endanger it? I mean, it doesn't make – we're talking about laws of gravity here, laws of political gravity. And I think that's what you're talking about.
I agree. I mean, and I'll just give you, Barry, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to give you two quick examples, and we can pick this up at our next program. But I'll just give you two quick examples where I think the Democrats are hurting themselves. Where the first one is abolish ICE. Look, ICE is not the problem. The ICE is simply carrying out the policies or the law the way it is. So if you don't like what ICE is doing, you can change the law or get angry with the president, but not with ICE. ICE itself is not the problem. So when they say abolish ICE, I think a lot of people look at that and say that's crazy, including some Democrats like your own senator up there. The other issue is on health care. I mean, the Democrats have an opportunity on health care to present a rational alternative to Obamacare, but they're talking about giving basically free Medicare for all. Well, they talked about that in California, and the numbers didn't add up, and the numbers are not going to add up in any other state. So I think those are the two things where I feel they're shooting themselves in the foot, where they have opportunities to promote their candidates with a rational health care and a more rational immigration, but it just seems to me that they've gone in the other extreme, Barry. We've got a couple of minutes, so I just want to hear your reaction to what I just said.
Well, I think you're correct. I think there are some major issues in education, where, you know, public education in America is in trouble, especially in higher education. University level education is so much political. I mean, even our best universities seem to be obsessed with political correctness and compromising the educational programs, and especially in the undergraduate level, especially in the liberal arts. And we've got crises. We need new roads. We need infrastructure change. There's a whole bunch of issues out there, but the Democrats are not really addressing them except in very sensational ways that appeal to their party base, but not necessarily to a larger group of voters.
Right, and that's my whole point about shooting themselves in the foot, that they're telling each other what they want to hear, but they misunderstand the point you made before, that elections are not won in the extremes. I mean, Republicans are going to vote for Republicans, Democrats are going to vote for Democrats, but there's those people in between who decide elections. And I don't think you're going to win them over with some of these obscene and crazy tactics that we've seen. Well, Barry, our time is up, but as always, I want to thank you so much for your time. Keep up the great work at the Prairie Editor, and we'll do this again. We'll do this again in a few weeks, because I love doing these shows with you.
Well, I enjoy them too, and I'm sure we're going to have interesting developments as the summer proceeds.
I think so, and I'm looking forward to bringing Mexico into the next few shows, because I think there's going to be some interesting things that there may be, just speculation on my part, but I'm taking a guess here. I think López Obrador and President Trump could very well meet before he takes over. I have a hunch that that's going to happen, Bill.
Well, could be.
Could be. All right. Well, thank you for your time. Happy July 4th, and we'll do it again.
Thank you. Good night.
All right. Good night. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor, one of our very favorite political analysts. Always love talking with him and getting his thoughts on what's happening in the country. Make sure you take a look at the Prairie Editor as your source of information and analysis. It's one of the best out there. I absolutely love getting my inputs and my notices that new articles are coming out. Barry does an absolutely fantastic job analyzing just about everything going on in our politics today. Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful July 4th. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.